Welcome to this edition of This Is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment. This edition is sponsored by the Tricord Group, leading successful relationship constructs for over 25 years, and VIM, helping the architecture and design disciplines design, deliver, and operate better buildings for a better world. And now, your co-hosts, Dave Gilmore and Lynn Barrett.
Our guest today is Peter Devereaux, Principal Chairman and CEO of Harley Ellis Devereaux. Peter is an architect specializing in the innovation of professional practice and project delivery methodologies. His expertise in professional practice, project delivery, mergers and acquisitions, and marketing professional services are of keen interest to us. Peter, welcome to This Is Design Intelligence.
Peter, Dave Gilmore here. We're so glad that you joined us and you're on the West Coast and we're over here in the eastern part of the U.S. here on this particular day. And we are living in a new context at this point with the COVID-19 virus moving across the world. And so we're getting the opportunity to do this podcast in a virtual environment. I'm going to jump right in and just ask you, you know, Harley Ellis Devereaux, as we affectionately refer to it as HED, is known as a truly integrated solutions firm. People use that term quite often, but I don't think they really understand what it means and how it practices. So maybe in your words, you could tell us, what does that mean at HED? And how have you been able to truly achieve functional integration across multiple disciplines for such a strong track record of time?
Sure, Dave. I think a lot of it has to do and has been reinforced by, I would say, the evolution of the design industry. We believe that buildings today are much more complex organisms than they were 50 or 100 years ago. Our firm is over 100 years old. And as such, it's no longer, I believe, a situation that a single individual can hold in their head all of the expertise that's required to make a truly great building. And as a result, we think that great architecture really comes about when you have an integrated team of experts working together. And so that's essentially how we've organized our design process. So for us, it's very important to have a kickoff meeting with all the experts on hand. And we utilize a design process that's sort of built around the idea of goals, strategies, and results. Hmm. So the goals are set prior to kickoff with the client. And the strategies are what we develop when we bring the expertise of engineers and landscape architects and all sorts of professionals that go into making a great building. We bring them together and we say, what sort of design strategies can we put in place to achieve these goals? And then those strategies get communicated to the entire team. So, you know, I'm old enough to remember that design process used to be that there were design leaders and production people. And today we really look at everyone who's on a project team as a designer because they understand those goals and strategies and they can all contribute in everything that they're doing to creating great design. And so for us, it's sort of really in our DNA as a firm to be integrated in practice, whether all the people are in-house or some of the people on that project team are joining us from consulting firms. It's the same practice.
It's interesting that you referred to the building as an organism. Talk to us more about that, because that's a living thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're looking at, you know, when we talk about goals for the project, and I should say that this the whole idea for us shifting our design process around the goals, strategies, results had a lot of interesting implications for us. First of all, the fact that we have an end result in mind means that we have to figure out how to measure that. So that's a pretty interesting thing for us right from the get-go. So when we're setting the strategies, we're also thinking about how we're going to measure the results. And we have also found that the idea of having goals for the project is not as easy as it may sound. We find that there's a carryover in the world out there that, say, purchasing departments sometimes are involved, facilities departments are involved in retaining design firms, and they aren't necessarily people who have the actual goals of the institution or business at heart. They're more worried about a charge to maintain a schedule and a budget. And so part of the challenge for us is actually making sure we're getting to the CEO or the people who have strategic goals in mind for the university or hospital or whatever it is that we're working on, and that we can come up with usually a number of goals. And so having laid that out and getting directly to the point of your question, we find that sometimes those goals are around performance of energy. Sometimes those goals are behavioral. In other words, does the environment we're creating advance the mission of the institution we're designing for? And how do we measure that? And so we look at buildings as having these behavioral impacts. That's basically, you know, we talk about what is our mission as a firm, and it's to have a positive impact for our clients and the communities they serve. And so we're always asking of every building, what is the positive impact it brings for our client and the community? And we then, in turn, sell that as our value proposition when we go to market.
Mm, thus, organic in nature. That's fantastic. Lynn?
Wanted to move to talking about the firm has morphed over time as a result of surgically executed merger acquisition strategies over several years. What have you learned through the ups and downs of this journey?
Sure. I would say lessons learned is that we headed out on that path, I would say, without proper education. And as such, we learned trial by fire, by error, by the school of hard knocks. I think we were lucky that we did do anything that caused us any great harm. But my advice to anybody going down that path is to find some good advisors, people who have been through the process, who have experience specific to our industry. And probably the biggest advice would be, do not underestimate the amount of effort and expense required to make mergers and acquisition activities a success. There are lots of horror stories out there, and I think most of those are the result of people moving forward with sort of rose-colored glasses, seeing only the strategic possibilities and not understanding all of the operational hard work that has to go forward to make the integration process work and keep all the good talent within the firm and get there. So I have to say, we have gotten educated. We have gone to lots of seminars and conferences, and we've learned a lot from experience, and I think we now approach it in a much more organized fashion and with much more success than we have in the past.
Those are really great points that you bring out. We found that, you know, the real work begins when the ink dries, you know, on the deal, and keeping people in the boat is not always an easy thing to do, that's for sure.
Well, and actually, I think that's something that we do perhaps a little bit differently than a lot of the industry. At least I keep hearing this from everyone when we're going through the process, especially from consultants who say, well, we've never heard anybody do that before. But we think the integration phase starts a minimum 3 months prior to close. Because here's our philosophy. A firm is coming to join us. They have clients that have relied on them, who they've served over the years. The first 30 days after we've announced the merger is a little bit of a honeymoon period, but the clients are watching very carefully. And if we haven't done lots of work in advance of that so that our new partners are really well integrated and well prepared to answer the call and not stumbling over a period of the first quarter of trying to learn new processes and procedures and where to find things and how to respond to an RFQ and how to get the drawings out and get the, you know, all the things that you do as a normal basis, you now have to do in a slightly different way as part of a new organization. If you stumble over that first 30 days, it's a big setback and a hard hill to climb to regain client confidence. So that's why we spend so much time up front before the close, working to get prepared for the big announcement.
That's fantastic. So we're in this COVID-19, aka new coronavirus dynamic. It seems to be devastating so many status quo constructs on multiple dimensions of work and life. Very interesting to watch the reactions. At Design Intelligence, we are kind of the recipient of many, many calls from around the world, people sharing their stories as well as asking questions about, so what's now next? And we get to field a lot of that and have been for the last week. You've been leading, and your insight into the overall industry for many years has really kept HED on task over time. You've seen deep recessions. You've seen the fallout of 2008, 2009. And before that, you saw the one that came before that, et cetera. And now we're here in this new construct. I'm not going to say that the industry has stopped, nor that we've entered a recession. I think we've entered a very ambiguous time to try to figure out, where are we? Can you give us some of your insights and how you're reacting and guiding your firm around this very ambiguous, foggy place where we're finding ourselves at this point?
Yeah, and I would agree with you. It's difficult to forecast at the moment, and the situation seems so fluid and changing day to day. I don't know if it's fortunate or not, but we had our board meeting, we had a retreat scheduled for yesterday and the day before last, which rapidly turned into a virtual meeting instead of an actual meeting. I should say that our firm, 450 employees, were mostly remote by the end of last week, and as of Monday and this week have been, I would say, fully work from home remote, except for the occasional IT person who has to go in and mine to the servers and do some other things at our locations. So it has been a time of rapid change. For the board meeting that we just came through, I asked our CFO to model a 30% revenue reduction over the next 4 months, just so that we could do some scenario planning. We think, and we've already started to see a little bit of projects have their schedules slowed down. And I think that's coming from the ability of the clients. They're also all moving to a new remote environment, and they're not able to keep up with things on normal schedules, so they're slowing us down a bit. We've also seen some projects be put on hold, where people are just saying that we want to wait and see. There's just some big expenditures of the funds, and we're going to just wait for 2 months or so and see what's developing. And then we've had some projects that just outright stopped. We had a new corporate headquarters for a firm that does national event planning, and they've been devastated. So they just shelved their project. So we don't know the extent of how much of that will play out over the next, and whether 4 months, you know, we don't know. It could be 30 days. It could be 6 months. We just don't know. So we're just trying to, we sort of put together a toolkit of actions that we can be taking and being prepared to dive into that toolkit as the situation unfolds.
Well, I like that. The fact that you've created a toolkit and you're populating that kit with a series of tools. And I believe that the best practice of scenario planning against some different variables will better inform the board on making good decisions for everybody. The fact that you're technology folks have done a great job of enabling your people to get to home and to build the pipes and the necessary bandwidth for people to keep going is a real tribute to them. And so I kind of created this thing while you were talking: go, slow, pause, stop. Those are kind of the four categories of projects at this time. Not everything has stopped; they're still going. Some have slowed down, others are pausing, and others are stopping. And our hope is that we have less stoppage and more reversal here on this track where we're going. This is a time for cooler heads to prevail, that's for sure, during this time.
I would add there might be one more category there, which we're certainly hoping for and working towards, which is also new opportunities for services that are created by the crisis. And so we are seeing a call to action in our healthcare studio, and you know, and also we're doing a lot of we're basically building the cloud. So we, data centers all over the country is a big sector for us, and my goodness, the demand for things technological has certainly stepped up in the past couple of weeks here.
Well, that's fantastic. It's a great insight. Lynn, you want to take us in a different direction.
Yeah, just maybe a little bit back into your past, Peter, in kind of looking at something Caesar Pelli, who's the Yale Dean and architect, was that. And he said what he liked in you is that you were more of a leader and you thought more about the practice than other students did when you were attending Yale. Were you consciously thinking more about practice than design when you were in school?
That's interesting. Well, I think design came easy to me. That was actually my strength. That's what got me admitted into Yale. I'll also say that I was the first person from either side of my family to attend college, and came from really, be an understatement to say, modest means. I was at Yale basically on a full scholarship. And so I think that while some of my fellow students were focusing solely on design, I really knew I needed to figure out how I was going to make a living. I was not a gentleman architect by any means. And so I think I was just naturally curious about, well, so how do you make money doing this? How do you go out and get hired? And I was actually, work moonlighting while I was at Caesar's office, believe it or not. I was designing some houses on Nantucket. I actually had three people back in my apartment drafting while I was sitting in Caesar's office designing projects. Yeah.
So this is probably good advice for current students in architecture.
Well, I this is certainly a different time now. I think the curriculum is different in schools of architecture, and I think that's positive. And, you know, I think students are also entering the field, at least it seems to be my impression when I visit schools, for slightly different reason. I think it was more artistic expression, was more of a goal a generation ago, and now it's more about having some positive impact on the environment and communities, which is all good, I think.
Yeah, it is all good. I have also been looking at the fact that you, I believe it's true, it's that you gave the University of Southern California the idea for its Harry Potter dining hall, which they actually ended up building.
Well, I'll tell you how that came about. We competed to be selected for the Village at USC, which is a project that started under a prior administration at the University of Southern California. Oh. And one of our previous clients, Rick Caruso, he's the head of the Board of Trustees. He was a member of the Board of Trustees at the time, was spearheading in some ways because he was envisioning the project as not a part of the campus so much, but as a destination retail development that also then supported some university housing towers. But they could never quite get the financial pro forma for the thing to make 100% sense to the university in order to kick off the project. So it percolated for a few years. A new president came in, Max Nikias, and his vision changed. He said, let's make this a 15-acre extension of the campus to the north, and downplay, it's no longer a destination retail location. It's really a student housing-focused development with a significant retail component, but one that's focused on the local community, not the broader range. And so because President Nikias was so directly involved, we had the opportunity when we made our first presentation of the concept design to do it to the president and his cabinet, which hadn't happened. They hadn't had an architect make a presentation to the university president and his cabinet in over 20 years at the university.
Wow.
That's sort of another example of, I think, what has happened of this disjunction between the people who understand the goals and objectives of the university having some intermediary of a facilities group between the architect and that group. So we were happy to have that opportunity. We made the presentation and it was received very well. They really liked the strategies that we had come up to be able to deliver institutional-grade buildings and not have an exorbitant price tag associated with it. And so they had some little food and wine reception after this, because it was a lengthy presentation of a very large project. And I went up to Max Nikias afterwards, and I said, Max, you know, we see this, one of the goals of this is being able to help the university in recruiting top-notch students and athletes and the most desirable people that you want to bring to the university. And I said, you know, I have college-age children myself, and one of the things that I've observed is that since they were youngsters, with every Harry Potter book that came out, I would read them a chapter a night before bed until they got old enough where they didn't want to do that and they wanted to devour the book themselves as quickly as they could after it came out. And they all have this image now of college being like Hogwarts. That's the goal. And I said, I had just come back from taking a college tour and stopped at Yale. And I said, my youngest daughter chose Rice University because it had residential colleges that just sounded a lot like Hogwarts. And I said, when they close the deal and try and bring in the top-notch student at Yale, where do they do it? They bring them to the dining hall. And the student walks into this cathedral-like space, and their eyes get wide as saucers, and they go, oh, my goodness, this is where I'm going to have lunch every day, and this is like Hogwarts. And Max immediately got the idea, and he said, yes, I have to have one of those. Put one of those in the project. And so that's how it got started.
That's brilliant. I love that story. And it's a beautiful building, too.
Thank you. I wish we could have. The one thing that happened that got out of our control was the furnishings for the dining hall went to, you know, the standard university furniture procurer and did not meet the level of Hogwarts furniture.
That might be a bit difficult.
Although I have to say the university immediately started, they saw the result and I didn't have to say anything. They've been working on that ever since.
That's great. Well, I'm going to end with a question that's something we've asked everybody who's been joining us in our conversations. And it's probably a question you've been asked a lot, but we're asking it of everybody. What's the first building that made a big impact on you?
Oh, okay. You know, that's pretty easy, I think. When I first enrolled at Penn State, and incidentally, I went there for the track team and picked architecture because I had a kind of an understanding that I love to draw and build models, that maybe as an architect I could do that and get paid for it, which sounded pretty good. So we went on a field trip to West Virginia to Falling Water, which is Frank Lloyd Wright's incredible house design.
Of course.
And
yeah.
We happened to go there in the fall when all the trees were in this gorgeous autumnal colors, brilliant blue sky, arrived on a crisp fall morning, walked through the woods as you did in those days, and the house was just magnificent. The way it sprung out over the water, the way the water went over the waterfall, the way the little spring bubbled up in the corridor back by the bedrooms, and the water flowed past the big hearth and the big kettle that was used for heating apple cider and the central hearth that heated the whole home. It was just breathtaking and inspiring. And I think that was the first realization I had that architecture can really have a big impact on how people feel and then how they act. So for me, that was the first.
You've painted a beautiful picture for us. That's awesome.
Well, it's been great to be with you, Peter. We want to thank you for joining us, and we're going to look forward to more of this. I think we've only scratched the surface on your perspective and stories that come not only from you, but from the leadership of your organization, which continues to inspire all of us in the work that you're doing. So thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. And listeners, it's great to be with you. Remember, we want to hear from you. We want to learn from you and get to know you. Reach out at thisisdesignintelligence.com.
Until next time.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of This Is Design Intelligence, sponsored by the Tricord Group and VIM. The producer for This Is Design Intelligence is Laura Spells. Sound engineering by Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.